Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast focused on the martial arts, with a focus on Kenpo, I should say. And I am Reggie Darden, and I'm excited to be chatting with Angelo Collado today. And we're going to get into his great story and hopefully get some nice Frank Trejo stories just kind of whatever else that we happen to get into. Just kind of a little bit about me. I have advanced ranks in Kenpo. I'm currently a green belt. I also have some experience in Taekwondo and Hapkido and did some boxing. And I also have an advanced rank in Capoeira. And as of recently, I've just started training in Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. So I'm doing the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu thing. So, yeah, I'm just having a lot of fun getting in all the knowledge I can and hopefully not injuring myself too much. And, so let's turn it over to our esteemed guest here. I wanted to hear how Kenpo found you, how the martial arts found you, or where did it all start for you? And we'll just kind of go from there. So we'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. Welcome. Thanks for having me out here. This is going to be a fun little episode, I hope. I got started way back. I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I was got started back when I was 10, 12 years old. I started with a Chinese organization. It was just a Chinese-based kung fu studio. And I started training with those guys. And I took that for about a year and a half. And all we did was just the basic fundamental exercises, stuff like that. But I really wanted to learn how to fight, and I couldn't get what I needed out of that. It was just all discipline of stretching and so forth. So I kept looking around, and then I found this place called Treco International in Albuquerque. And that was with Tom Connors and Albuquerque and the Tracy system. So I started training with those guys, and I started when I was 12, 13 years old. And that place was known for its fighters. It had some of the world-class fighters around. The head instructor there was Bill Packer. And back in the day, and that was back when the PKA was real big, we had some world champions that were fighting out of there. And I went to a school called Albuquerque High School. And I was a very social guy. So every time I'd go out, there'd always be this group of guys who were always the guys everybody wanted to hang out with. If there was ever any trouble, these guys would always handle it. You know, they were the macho fighter guys. And so I kind of wanted to hang out with those guys and everything. So I figured out that they were going to that particular school. And so I started training there. And my instructors there was Sal Montoya. And he took me under his wing, and he was going to school with me. And so he basically, at that school there, was a fighting school. Tracy, it was a Treco school. It was known for its kickboxing and mostly survival. You'd walk in the door, and it says, through these doors walk the world's greatest fighters. And then they would wear T-shirts that say, if we don't get along, let's get it on. And it was kind of, you know, a real kind of a macho-y, tough guy place. And if you belonged in there, then that was a good thing from where I came from, because I came from Albuquerque, a lot of neighborhoods, a lot of, not gangs, but a lot of serious neighborhood clashes that we always had. And so I started with that. And at that particular school, we did the curriculum. It was air Kenpo, I called it. Now I called it that. It was just doing the moves in the air. And you had to, you know, you'd have all your belts and everything else. But then the whole presence was just based on fighting. Can you fight? How much can you fight? And we would fight and work our way through it. And I was lucky at purple belt. And going to blue belt, I got asked to be a junior instructor, which was a real honor at that school. We got to wear our fancy uniforms. And we always stood out, and you were a special guy. And so we got to teach the kids, and we'd always get the younger belts. And so I became a junior instructor as a purple belt, and that's when I actually started teaching. That was like in 1975, 76 area. And from there, I just stayed and worked and worked and worked and worked and finally got through the entire system there. And then I opened a school for Mr. Packer in Tucson, Arizona, and I started going out that way. But then I started really wanting to learn about the American Kenpo that Ed Parker did. So I pretty much packed up all my gear from Albuquerque. I had a big fitness center there. And I ended up getting rid of the fitness center and packing all my gear up and moved to California in search of Ed Parker and his studio and trying to find out what American Kempo was all about. And so that's how I ended up in California from Albuquerque.
Very nice. I can relate in that the first school that I trained at was essentially under the Tracy lineage. Could go back to Dick Willett, if you're familiar with him. So my instructor fell under that lineage. So yeah, I can relate to that, and I can relate to the air kempo, the air karate. We did a lot of techniques in the air. I mean, we certainly worked them on each other, but not nearly as much as the training that I'm under now. It's been quite an awakening. Doing five swords on on another person versus
in the air.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. It was like that, you know, and that school was just predominantly about fighting. And we had the likes of, I'm sure you've heard of Michael Winklejohn, who does Jackson Winklejohn for the MMA guys. We got our black belts together back in that same school in Albuquerque. And guys like John Moncayo, Steve, we had so many world champions that were fighting out of that school. So it was all about how hard could you fight, you know, and that's basically what it was. So that was a good base, and I learned how to fight. But as far as the martial arts go, I did some forms. The forms were really cool. And so I got into doing the forms back then also. But mostly it was because of the fighting. So when I came to California looking for Kempo, it was a whole different world. You know, I thought I knew Kempo. And that's how I ended up, the story that I ended up meeting is I started going to a gym. And I found a place to live. And I started going to an LA Fitness out here in California. And there was this guy working out, and he had on an Ed Parker t-shirt. And I went up to him right away. I says, "Oh, do you know Ed Parker? You wear Ed Parker t-shirt?" And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Who are you?" And I told him who I was. He goes, "What do you want?" And I said, "I know Kempo." And he goes, he laughed at my face. And he goes, "No, you don't." And I said, "What do you mean I don't?" He goes, "You don't know Kempo." And I just said, "No, really, I'd like to learn Kempo." And he was just like, you know, "He'll talk to me some other time." So we ended up working out for a couple weeks, and I kept asking him. And then finally, he agreed to... He goes, "Well, let me take you, invite you over to my house, and let's see what you got." So, you know, we started doing some stuff, and he looked at me, and he goes, "Let's put the gloves on." So we put the gloves on, and we sparred a little bit, you know, around. And he goes, okay, see, I can see you can fight. Okay, that's cool. So it was kind of like an introduction. He was a screening there. So finally, he allowed me to go with him to the Friday night class in Pasadena, Ed Parker's Friday Night Lion class. And that's where it all began for me, that crazy night in Pasadena. And that story was a crazy story. That's how I met everybody. And basically, they run the technique line. And these guys were the best black belts of Ed Parker had. He was the Friday Night Line. And a lot of the guys are names that nobody's ever heard of because these guys, they just trained Kempo. They didn't care about teaching. They didn't care about going out there. They were just Ed Parker's main inner circle. And the Friday Night Line guys were fierce. And so I jumped in my line. I walked in. I opened the door and walked in. Everybody just kind of stared at me, and you could hear them laughing. "Well, we got another one here. Here we go. You know, let's see what he's got." And so I jumped in line, and within the first two or three techniques, everybody, you know, knew I was getting hit left and right. I was getting beat up. I couldn't block. I tried to do techniques that didn't work. You know, nothing worked on these guys, and I kept getting hit and kept getting hit and get hit and beat up and hit in the face. And, you know, and it was no fun because nobody really even talked to me. They were just like, you know, "Are you stupid, dude? Get out of here." So anyway, I completed the class. You know, I had a fat lip and bloody nose and the whole bit. And Steve kind of looked at me, goes, "Well, this is Kempo." You know, and I was like, shoot, you know, I didn't say anything. We got in the car. He dropped me off back at his house. I went home. And there was nearly no words were said that day. But then the next Friday, I showed up at his house again. And I said, "Hey, I'm ready to go." And he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, I'm going to go back. I want to do this again." So I went back the second time and got my ass kicked again. And these guys are like, "This, you know, this guy's stupid." Going techniques and so forth. And there was this one guy named Kong. His name is Ken Johnson, big old dude, you know, 6'5", 300 some pounds, and he was the main guy there. And Roger Meadows, Josh Furuya, all those guys were doing it. And I remember the second night I was there, I kept hearing laughing of what's going on. And in the old Parker school, there was a big window. And in that window was Ed Parker sitting in a chair, just laughing his ass off at me. And I heard another guy, and that was Trejo. Trejo was laughing too, because every time I get hit and fall down to the floor, they just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And I got my ass beat left and right, and you know, and I just kept coming back for more. And then I came back, and eventually Mr. Parker leaned over to Trejo and said, "Hey man, why don't you go give this guy a hand?" You know. So that's Trejo came out and introduced himself to me, and all of a sudden there was a hand that came up, helped me up, and Yosh Furuya, who was one of the other major guys there, said, they took me to the side and they said, let's start with learning how to block. So they were holding my hand and they're doing all this stuff. They said, you got to learn how to block and this and that. And so Frank Trejo kind of, you know, took me under his wing at that point. So did Yosh. And they started working with me quite a bit. And so I came back another time, and I came back another time, and it was getting better. People were talking to me a little bit. Until one day, the tradition was you go work out and do the Friday Night Line, and in Pasadena, you'd go to Shakey's, and you'd have fried chicken and pizza and beer. You know, that was it. That was everybody did that, work your butt off and go kick back with the guys. And so I started going home one day, and this little guy named Wayne Yatusaki, he was smaller than me, and he was kind of a guy who was just kicking everybody's butt. I just loved watching him. He turned around, and I was going towards my car, and he goes, "Hey." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Aren't you coming?" And I said, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, aren't you coming for pizza tonight?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And I ran, and I went to go have pizza with the guys. And at that moment, that was kind of like an acceptance into the Friday Night Line, into the black belt at Parker School. And so I started going to Friday Night Lines there and started working out with the guys in Pasadena. And unfortunately, Yosh was going to open up another school. So Yosh and Mr. Johnson were opening up a school in Glendora. And what happened was they opened up a school, and they neither one of them wanted to teach kids. They wanted to teach adults and so forth. So I kind of was hanging out with these guys. I said, you know, I just came from a school, and that's all I did was teach kids. I'd love to help you guys out. So they agreed, and they let me come into the school, and I was starting to help and start teaching the kids. And it was, and I got to still continue working out, and we were getting ready to open up the school, big old grand opening that we were going to have. And that happened. I remember that that day in December 15, where Mr. Parker passed away at the airport, and I can recall the day that we were just working out, and all of a sudden Mr. Johnson walked in and just had this look on his face, and he said that Senior Grandmaster Edmund Parker had passed away, and he just walked out, and the school just, I mean, it was silent. It was one of those moments that nobody could remember. I mean, it was just horrible. And so the school kind of shut down that day, and we didn't resume till after all the stuff was going on, the funeral and everything else. So we came back, and so at that point, Yosh and everybody, there was no reason to go to Pasadena, so they opened the school in Glendora. So all the black belts from Pasadena left the Pasadena school, and they came to our school in Glendora and started working out with Ken and Roger Meadows, and all the guys came. So that became the new place for the Friday Night Line, was in our school in Glendora, California. And that was in the 1990 that happened. And then from that point on, we came and Mr. Johnson went off and opened up another school somewhere else. And so Yosh and I continued, and we opened up a school together in Glendora, and we moved. And then we had that school all the way through the early 90s to mid 90s. And that's where all the black belts continued to work out. And that's pretty much, I was one of the owners of the school, but I had 13 black belts in front of me. And I could never teach the adult class because I had 13 black belts in front of me who were all my teachers. And so I came up in a very, very awesome place because I had black belts that were amazing all around me, teaching me, showing me tricks, doing this and that. My main instructor was Yosh Furuya and Frank Trejo. Those were the two that really stuck to me. And but still, I trained with all the other guys, and they just, you know, real fortunate, you know. I was never able to be a teacher. I was always a student, you know, and I could only teach the kids, which was cool. And I enjoy teaching the kids. And to this day, there's several of them that started with me, my son also. He was 2 years old when we opened up the school, and now he's just in his 30s now. AJ, he's a fourth-degree black belt, and he's been with me at my side. And there's a couple other kids that made it all the way through who are now third- and fourth-degree black belts who started with me when they were 9 years old. And so it's a cool thing. It's all there. And so now everybody's doing their own thing. You know, everybody's moved on and stuff. And so I stuck with the school. Then I decided to pull away from the school probably in 1993, 94. And then that's when I started my competition career and started traveling around Europe . Bob White had the Karate on the Beach in 1998. And that was a huge competition. And I also wanted to get started in the internationals competing at the Long Beach. That was another big thing. When I was at my school, kind of backtracking, I always said I always wanted to win something. And they, back in the day, they called it taking home some wood. And they said, yeah, I'm going to take home some wood. And I said, one of these days, I want to do that too. And they would just laugh at me. Trejo would just pat me on the head and laugh at me. He goes, you're never going to win anything. He goes, I really want to do this. And the other guys were like, nah, nobody wins. You can't just go out there and say you're going to win. I mean, it's a dream. It's a dream. Dream on. And so I started working really hard. And I went up to Trejo and I said, you know, Trejo, I need you to help me. And so I started working that at Camp Trejo in Frank Trejo's garage. And he took me under his wing, and he was a showmanship. He was one of the better guys back in the day. Better fighter, one of the best forms guys. And I said, who else to teach me, you know? So he took me under his wing and taught me showmanship and worked with me hard and so forth. And I competed I entered the internationals, and nothing happened for about 4 or 5 years. And then in 92, me and a friend named Joseph, we ended up doing forms. It was creative forms. And we made up this huge, huge routine that included two-man set and so forth. So we ended up competing and we ended up winning. And that was amazing. But it wasn't a single. It was a double effort, you know. But that was a step closer to doing what I wanted to do. We got exposure. And then I competed another year or two, nothing. And then finally, I ended up winning the men's Kempo division, men's black belt division in Long Beach. And then that same year I went on to win the grand championship and at internationals and being the first Kempoist to actually win the total grand championship, you know, because you would win the Kempo division and you'd be the grand Kempo division, but then you'd have to go compete against all the winners of all the other styles, the Wushu guys, the Kaja Kempo guys, the Japanese guys, the self-defense guys. And so all of us were on stage together competing. And I happened to pull it off and win the grand championship, first Kempo guy to actually make it all the way through. And that was with the help of Mr. Trejo. And that was an incredible year. And then in 98, Mr. Bob White had Karate on the Beach. And the winning was that if you were to win grand champion in that tournament, you would get an all-expense-paid trip to Europe representing Team USA in the World Championships in Europe. And that was motivating as hell for me. So I started training every day hard. And in 98, I ended up going and training and competing at Karate on the Beach, and I ended up winning the men's forms division and won grand champion in that tournament. And so I got to go to Europe, which was fun. And it was me, Dave Thompson, and a guy named Alex Armitage. We were the three representatives of the American Kempo. We were the three that Alex won the fighting. Dave Thompson won the self-defense. And I also won the forms division. So that was our team. And then when we got there, we competed in the European Championships. And it was tough because I got to beat the Europeans for the first time. And I just did my thing, you know, and I ended up winning the men's Kempo division in Europe. So I won that, and Dave Thompson went, and he ended up winning the self-defense division. And then Alex Armitage went and ended up winning the fighting division. So we were great. John Sepulveda was our coach, and Paul Dye was there. And who else was at that meet? Jeff Speakman was around. Lee Wedlake was around at that tournament. They all went to Europe to watch. And we ended up saying, okay, so now we need an American fighting team. Well, I wasn't prepared. I'm not a point fighter. You know, I'm a contact kind of guy. And so we ended up putting together the team of me, Alex, and Dave Thompson. And we ended up getting in there, just getting psyched up and everything else. And we ended up winning our first fight, and I was all excited and everything else. And I never recall Dave Thompson shook my head and said, Angelo, we got to fight again. I said, what do you mean we got to fight again? We just won. He says, no, we got to keep going. So we ended up fighting six or seven countries. And we ended up in the finals against Ireland. They were undefeated. The McDermotts, there were three brothers, two brothers and a cousin, I think. And they were undefeated, the McDermotts. And we ended up fighting them in the finals. It was an exciting brawl. It was amazing. And we ended up losing by 1 point at the end. So we ended up getting the silver medal for the American fighting team. And that was in 98, the three of us. And then from that point on, everything just kind of grew from there. We got asked to teach seminars, and I continued to compete annually at all these events and had a fairly lucky, very fortunate winning streak with my forms. I didn't fight on the team again because it's like at that point I put my fighting away and I just wanted to do other things. I was getting older, and fighting really hurt my body a lot. So that's kind of where I went. So in a nutshell, that's kind of a real quick summation of what's where I was and how I got to where I was doing. So
yeah, very, very nice. I mean, that's there's a lot to unpack in that, and we'll definitely get to some of those points. I'm curious, taking it back to before you got into the American Kenpo side of it, one thing that I struggled with in kind of changing systems, did you, when you got involved in the American Kenpo side, did you have difficulty, you know, relearning the system, so to speak?
Well, yeah, I did. And I agreed to take off my belt, my black belt, and start over as a white belt. And I did that. And I showed up to my first lesson with a white belt on. And he said, no. Yosh said, I can't do that to you. You earned your black belt in a different system. I'm not going to take that away from you. So I wore a black belt. And I basically had to empty the glass completely and just say, you know what? Air Kenpo doesn't work. And I couldn't say, well, this is the way I used to do it. This is what we did. I got shut up so many times. He goes, I don't care what you used to do. Do you want to learn this or not? And I'm like, yeah, because then shut up and just do what we're doing. And then learning the applications of the Air Kenpo that I used to know, because a lot of the techniques were similar. They had a whole different name to them, but they were the same techniques without a check, you know, and some of them were very similar. And I still know that curriculum. And some of those techniques were really fun to do, but they were all Air Kenpo. You know, you go, hey, this is what's supposed to happen. But when you got to do it on a body, everything changes. And Yosh Faria is a master micro Kenpo technician. So you do one repetition now, you do thousands of repetitions of the same move. Inward block, inward block, inward block, step back, step back, step back. You know, your toes moving before your ankle. Don't do that. Just micro picked us apart. So the transition was difficult, but it wasn't if you would just listen and open your mind up to the new things. The contact of hitting something instead of just moving in the air fast. Being able to move in the air fast and also have effect on the body was a huge transition. I was bouncing off of everybody, you know, or someone would come throw a punch at me and I would block it and go flying because I had no base underneath me. So it was absolutely a relearning situation from the two. But then go back to your Tracy system and put in all these elements that I learned and the principles and concepts of American Kenpo. I still use some of those techniques because they're nice and they worked. But at that point, I didn't understand what I was doing, but now I do. So yeah, it was a great transition.
And like, there's a couple of things that you mentioned that I really like. One, mentioning the checks or lack of checks. I say that the checks are my kryptonite because my training now you know, I'll rock a technique. And my instructor's like, no, that was nice, but where was that leg check? Where was that check? And,
yeah.
So then, you know, I try to implement the check, and oh well, you forgot half of the rest of the technique. Well, I was thinking about the checks. Yeah, those checks get me, and really trying to reprogram that into my DNA now has definitely been a struggle. So I can definitely relate there. I also like that you mentioned taking the principles and things and importing them back into the Tracy, you know, Traco style. That's something that I've been kind of toying with in my training. Well, my original plan was, so I didn't get to my black belt at my first school. And when I started training at my current school, I had this big idea of, oh, well, I'm going to go back and you know, refresh all my techniques and all my information and go back and one day get my black belt there and then get my black belt at the current school. And that was all fine, well and fine when I had, you know, 10 techniques for yellow belts. And but once you start going up in the belts, it's a lot harder to do, do 40 techniques in one system. And our school's on a 16 technique curriculum. But once you start getting up there, there's a lot of information and freestyle and terminology and all these things that I didn't do at my first school. It's like, absolutely, now there's that stuff I have to worry about. So I've changed my game plan.
It's good. It's just it's such a scientific art, and once you learn it and decipher it, you know. And I'm sure you notice now the trends are changing also from traditional Kempo into modified Kempo, and that's a whole other system that's going on, a whole other story. You know, there's a lot of debates, as you see online, a lot of fighting, a lot of this, a lot of that going on. You know, why are you traditionalizing this? And you know, and so I understand the art, and I do believe that the art was at its peak in the early 70s and 80s. And I think from that point on, I think modifications needed to be made As Mr. Parker always said, he wants you to change the art with the times and don't traditionalize my art because it'll die. You know, you need to keep it moving. But then there are those hardcore people who say, no, you got to do it this way, you're doing it wrong. And I'm one of those guys who disagrees with that. I think that if you follow the concepts and principles and apply it to new movement, you're still following the Kempo tradition and you're making it work, but you're just not doing it with those things that are happening. So, you know, it's like taking a motor out of a car and putting it in a different car. It's still the motor, and you take that motor, that's what runs the whole thing, you know. And as long as you use those concepts and principles, you can plug it. I do that with my Filipino stuff that I do. I use Kempo base and Kempo principles, and it changes their art completely. It enhances a lot of things that they do in different arts. So I'm a firm believer in change. I'm a firm believer in evolution. However, you got to do it right. You don't have a base, and then you don't use your legs, and you don't follow the concepts and principles, then you're out. Then it's changed to the point where you're not doing Kempo anymore. You're just moving. You're going back to air Kempo.
Exactly. And,
Yeah. Just, you know, and the thing with it is, a lot of people weren't fortunate enough to have the old eyes on them. I was so fortunate to have all the old guys. I trained with all first generation guys. You know, my black belt tests, I had 10 or 12 guys on the board, and these guys all knew Kempo. So I got picked on my whole life on how to do everything. And I think a lot of the people out there, they just don't have that experience of having the older people on them. So there's a lot lacking the farther you are away from the source, in which people kind of make things up and just kind of do what they can because they never had that opportunity to train with some of these bigger guys, except for perhaps at a seminar or something like that. You know, we got busted daily. I think I could never do anything right ever in my school. And one quick story is I was getting ready to train. I was going to do internationals, and I think it was in 2015 or 14, something like that. And I had 3 10th degree black belts there at our workout. And I said, okay, I'm going to run form 6, and I want you guys to watch me, and I want you to stop me the minute you guys hear, you know, or see something they don't like. So I opened up, I did my salutation, and I did my first move in form 6, and all 3 of them yelled, stop! And I was like, are you kidding me? They go, no. They go, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're doing that. And so my whole demonstration of what I was thought was ready for competition turned into an hour and a half class on how to do form 6 again, you know? And that's what I'm used to. I'm used to everyone telling me, no, that's not right. Fix this, fix that, fix this. And I think that really helps. You know, you need that other set of eyes who know, watching you. And if you don't have those, then you lose it. You kind of go off on your own a little bit.
No, for sure. It's hard to hear the, you know, constructive feedback.
Yeah, but you need it.
But we all need it. You know, the people that have, you know, came before us, they know more than we do, and so we have to swallow that pill and get in all the information that's provided, as much as we don't want to believe it. I mean even with the limited time that I've been training, some days I think, man, I totally know all this stuff, and then,
oh yeah,
most other days I'm like, wow, how have I been doing this? Because I know very, very, very little, very little. So
it's good. One thing that I did too when I was coming up with the park or at the Parkers and with everything else at the Parker School, and then we moved to Glendora, is I was an advocate on video, and I videoed every one of my lessons with every one of my instructors. So I've got a ginormous collection of VHSs, but they're all getting converted into digital. But I see lessons of me learning all my forms for the first time, and I'm watching what they're teaching me. And I go back and I watch those all the time. And every time I watch, I'm like, wow, I forgot about that. And that means that if I would have never had those videos, I would have never taught those things, because I would have forgotten about them. So each generation, you're losing a whole bunch of stuff. And so my son, he started training. So I had my son, rather than me teach him a lot of the stuff, I had him train with my teachers. So he trained directly with Trejo, directly with Faria, directly with all the guys himself. And so he got what he got out of it directly from them. And then things that he didn't get, I would add to it. So he's got the videos also. He watches the videos. And, you know, he's like, look, Dad, you're doing it wrong. Look, Dad, that's not what he taught you. You know, he's correcting me now. But to have that source of the old videos, I thought was something that I cherish 100%.
Oh, yeah.
And people say, no, this is the way you're doing the form. I'm like, dude, I got video of Ed Parker teaching it this way. What are you saying? He says, well, he was wrong back then. I'm like, okay. You know, I'm like, I've got it all on tape. So if anyone ever gives me hassles, I just pop a little clip of a video up there, and they go, oh, wow, okay, that's cool. And then, you know, you can't argue with that.
Yeah, no, that's very huge. I still cry over the fact that I lost my green belt test tape. I would certainly like to go back and see how I was doing things a lot of years and a lot of pounds ago. And
videos help, though. Videos they tell all. Watch a video and you can see what you do wrong. You think you're doing it right until you watch the video. I'm like, nope, not there yet, you know?
Yeah, I've been trying to talk myself into videoing, you know, practice sessions, and, you know, going through a belt of stuff and just get it on video, you know, not for posting or anything like that, but just so that I have it and I can review as I go through my training and just kind of look at you know, what I'm doing, and have, when I do have questions or things like that, I can show them to my instructor or to some of these other great folks that I've had the opportunity to speak with, and go, okay, here, you know, pick it apart. Let's get down to what's going right, what's going wrong, more so what's going wrong, because I'm sure there's a lot more going wrong than going right, but yeah, just getting in there and really digging in and pulling apart everything and really getting to the meat of what I'm doing. So
mm-hmm.
definitely trying to get the courage to get that in more. So and take note. I'm really bad about writing down things. I really should do that more.
Writing down. Yeah, I use video instead. It's easier. Now I got my phone everywhere I train, you know, so it's a little bit easier to collect all the information. But yeah, it's important, very much so.
Very nice. So going back to the teaching side of it, you said that you got to start when you were a purple belt. Were you always interested in the teaching side of it, or was it more?
Yeah, I like teaching. I found that when I was teaching, I learned more. Because you'd make discoveries that you didn't even realize, but you kind of play it off like you knew it. Like, oh, wow, I just figured this out. But hey, check this out. And you learn a lot, and you learn a lot by watching others' mistakes of what to do and what not to do. So I was always involved with teaching. And so I got to the point where I got asked to open a school for them in Tucson and run a school for them. And I did that for a while and put you in a good position of authority. But then again, once you open a school, you get cut off from your source and you don't get lessons anymore. Now you're just giving, but you're not receiving. So you find that your training goes down the tubes the more you teach. And that's the dilemma of running a school. You know, if you run a school, you're always teaching and you're always teaching, but you're not learning as much as you could. So you got to keep that instructor somewhere and you got to take lessons yourself. But yeah, I love teaching. I think it's the best way to learn.
Yeah, I agree. You definitely get a better sense of it when you have to pick things apart so that you can explain it. And I know I take for granted that other people don't understand things the same way that I do. If I'm showing mm-hmm. a technique or something, I'm like, oh, well, it makes so much sense when I do this thing, but that's because of some of, you know, my other experience in other arts and just from doing this for so many years.
Oh yeah.
You know, this person, they're on their free trial class. So Starblock doesn't make as much sense to them as it does to me. So,
exactly.
It's easy to forget that.
And the evolution of the art too, is it's changed so much. I learned now, I think now Kempo's turned into more of a, I don't know, intellectual art, and for a lot of people, where they'll sit there and they'll recite word after word, phrase and phrase after that, but it's just words. You know, they're not moving. I learned the opposite. You know, I learned by feeling. I learned by getting hit, by getting beat up, and I would say, "How did you do that?" So I learned the tactical way when I was being brought up, and we did the basics, the words, the basic principles and concepts, marriage of gravity, torque, blah blah blah. But we didn't have all these other new things that nobody had. I mean, my teachers, Yosh and everybody else, Frank Trejo, you know, you got category completion. You got all this other stuff that's going on. And I remember Frank, I go, "Hey, Trejo," I said, "explain to me category completion." And he goes, "What? Okay." He goes, "Category completion, my fist hitting your face hitting the floor, category complete." And that's... that's the definition I would get coming up. It was always feeling. It wasn't words. I never had to recite. I never had to sit there and memorize. I had to perform and I had to feel. And that's the way I was brought up. And it's bewildering to see a lot of these schools that don't do that. It's just all about talk and words. And so they're getting back to the Air Kempo-ish. Then they're really not hitting anymore. They just kind of touch. They don't, you don't get that feeling of what Kempo was all about. And so, you know, I learned Kempo from the inside out is what I tell everybody, because, you know, the bruises and the pain that I felt made me understand what Kempo was all about. And so the words are very different. We don't do that anymore. So now, you know, I'm an old school guy, and you can bump heads a lot with a lot of the new guys because they want words. They want to sit there and move in slow motion and look at every little angle. And then I said, well, you know, so my basic thing now is just show me, you know, I'm a visual learner. Show me, I want to feel it. And that's the way I'll learn. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to talk about it. I want you to do it to me and show me how it feels. And usually nothing happens after that. They usually say, oh, my back hurts, my knees hurt. You know, I can't do that. My wrist is feeling weird today. I'm like, okay, that's fine. But yeah, I'm old school when it comes that way. We are all brought up that way.
Yeah, to feel is to believe. So
yep, that's all.
Right there with you. So in my Kempo journey, one of the names that is out there and is, I don't know, lifted up probably as much as Ed Parker is Frank Trejo. So I'm curious if you, I mean, I'm sure you have tons of stories we certainly won't have time to get into all of them today, but I was curious if you'd like to share a story or two of your time training with Mr. Trejo. Yeah. That you'd like to share.
Well, Trejo's Trejo, you know. I was fortunate enough to be with Trejo for 35 years. You know, I trained with him in his garage. He was like a father to me in a lot of respects. He was like my big brother, my father, my disciplinary, my mentor. And so hanging around Frank, there's two sides of Trejo. There were the people who partied with Frank, and there was the people who trained with Frank. And there were two different worlds. Very few people did both, unfortunately. And a lot of people who understand who Frank Trejo was understands what I just said. Because there's a lot of people who party with Frank. Frank's got, I mean, Mr. Frank would go, and he'd, you know, Mr. Tequila Man, he'd love to go out and party and doing all kinds of stuff. But yet, they didn't really train with Frank, you know. Where I was in the garage training with Frank all the time, but when it came time to go out and drink, I didn't go. I didn't go out and have fun, and I didn't party with Frank like everybody else did. I was more on the training side. So a lot of my stories are based on training, you know, things that he used to do, things that we used to do together, where the stories that everybody loves to hear are all the fun stories that happened too. So I know Frank in a different way. And then, I don't know, you probably know, I took care of Frank for the last 6 years of his life and made sure everything went through. And I was there with him through every surgery, everything. It was a tough ending of that whole thing. But, you know, Frank kept a sense of humor all the way to the end. And he would always make jokes, you know, as he was getting cut up piece by piece. But he would always make jokes. I got videos that I've never released yet of him just singing songs. And I have one in particular where, you know, I come to you with karate, my empty hands. You know, should I be forced to defend myself, my principles, and my honor? As we all know, Frank made one that said, I come to you with karate and whatever parts I have left. Should I be forced to get in my wheelchair and chase you down? And I have this video, and he just redid this whole creed. And that was Frank. Frank accepted who he was, and he just lived in the day. And he goes, this is who I am today. I remember the very first surgery that he had when they had to amputate his wrist, and they cut him probably a little bit above the wrist. And I remember rolling him out and seeing that. And the first thing he did when he woke up is he said, he stood up, he pulled the IVs out of his arm, and he goes, take a picture of me. And it's him holding his stump as if it were his fist. He goes, I want you to put that on the internet right now because I need everybody to know who I am today and who I am. I'm not who I was yesterday. He goes, this is Frank today. And that was the kind of man he was. You know, he always wanted to live in the moment. So You know, a lot of my stories are all based on training mostly. And I enjoy listening to all the crazy fun stories that I wasn't a part of. But yeah, we had a lot of fun times together. And I was with them all the time. We'd go, you know, we'd always go eat, you know, always go eating. I would love to eat like Mr. Parker. I always took care of him. When he got into situations where he needed help with his physical problems with his knees or his back or anything like that. But you know, I don't have any really crazy, crazy stories about Trejo like everyone else does, you know, unfortunately. But I know like guys like on the East Coast, Dan Mack and all the Brotherhood guys, they got some crazy stories. And if you want to ever get an interview with some fun, crazy stories, you got to call Dan.
Oh yeah, no, I did interview. I did interview him a few weeks ago. So
yeah,
as of this recording, the episode's not out yet. But he's a fun guy.
Trejo stories, and he has one of the best Trejo imitations of anybody I know. You know, but Frank was always, you know, it was all based on training when we were all together. You know, it was just do it this way, and you know, Frank would always do videos, and I got him on video where he's doing form three, and then all of a sudden he starts breakdancing and starts fooling around, and you know, he would always play the bongo drums, and we learned Kempo through rhythm. A lot of it, every technique has a sound, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I learned my forms that way through Frank, where he says, you sing a song in your head, and he would play the congas and play the drums for me while I was doing my workouts. And so he would always have these different ways of training and all these different methods that he would always share with me. And, you know, then when he would get mad at you really good. You know, I remember one time I got mad and I did something. I think I didn't show up. And remember KempoNet?
Oh, yes.
Back in the day? Oh, yeah. All of a sudden, Frank Trejo put on a big old message. He goes, Angelo, where are you? He goes, I don't hear from you. You're going to be sleeping with the fishes. You know, and he would always be mad at you about something you would do. And he would be really mad, and he would hold it against you for quite a while. Yeah, so I've got some good and bad stories, good up and downs, mostly good, mostly training stuff, you know. But nothing too crazy on my end anyway.
sounds good. Is there maybe one or two training tips that you got from him that really kind of stand out to you? Or?
Yeah, I mean, with Trejo, it was all about, like, you know, you'd ask him about what makes a good fighter. And, you know, Frank's thing is, you know, he didn't like to get hit. And so that makes a good fighter in Frank's eyes, because if you can always avoid getting hit, you're always going to be good. And then another big thing Frank always was saying is, you always give one. You always take one to give two. Take one to give one. Take one to give one. Get hit in the nose, deliver a right hook, boom. You know, you're always going to, that's how you get better. Is you take one to deliver one. And those were the big thing. And he always used to tell me and my son, he goes, you know, if you're fighting somebody and you're a fourth degree black belt and you're fighting a fifth degree black belt, he says, as soon as he hits you, you got to go sixth on him. You got to hit him with a sixth degree. And then if he hits you back and you hit you, then you got to go eighth. Then you got to go ninth. Then you got to go tenth. He goes, you don't take it. Always up one on everybody. And always talk smack. That's what he always taught us. He goes, always talk smack. He goes, you can win the fight before the fight starts if you look at them right and you say the right things, you know? And he said that's what he used to do when he used to fight all the time. For showmanship and forms, he would basically just, he would always tell me, he goes, once you start, you just visualize what you're doing and just let it go, man. And he was such a motivator. He'd always be there. He was always be there for you, and he would always pump you up, get you ready for competition and so forth. I remember when my son was fighting, he was boxing in the ring, and Frank was his guy, and me and him were in his corner, and he would just calm you down. He'd rub your chest, he'd calm you down, and he would just say, you know, now it's time. Take one, deliver two. Take one, deliver two. You know, keep it moving. And you could always tell a Trejo guy. And that's one thing that I can see. When people say they trained with Trejo, all I got to say is, let me see you move. And if they don't move like Frank, they didn't train like Frank. Because anybody who trained with Frank moved like Frank. He made sure you did it. And there's certain things that you can do that you would go, oh, yeah, you're a Trejo guy, 100%. or you'll go, okay, you know, you met him once, you know, but he was a very special man to everybody. And he was an amazing fighter and amazing forms and an amazing human being. One of my favorite people of all my life.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. I think I would definitely get along with him well. And
oh yeah. I wish everybody could have met him. I mean, he went too early. He was 60. He was in his mid-60s when he passed away. And, you know, I would have loved to have seen him. But his goal was he wanted to live until he was 60. He wanted to beat Mr. Parker. That's what he always told me. He wanted to live 1 year longer than Mr. Parker. And after he got 60, he was kind of like, okay. You know, but then all the illness came in. But then the man was a fighter. He was a fighter till the very end, you know. Amazing to be with him.
Very nice, very nice. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the future of Kenpo? Where do you see it going? Where would you like to see it going?
I think Kenpo's going in a weird direction right now. And I think unless we reel it back in, it's going to take off into a place where I don't want to see it go. The growth of the art is huge. As you know, it's worldwide. I travel around the world teaching. I was in Spain, Mexico, Belgium this year teaching. And it's much more passionate in Europe and in South America than it is in the United States. The United States has gotten a little bit laxed on their basics and so forth. And I think that the art is developing in such a way that it's turning into more of a visual art as opposed to a physical art. And I don't like to see that. I mean, there's people that hit and they hit hard and they hit fast, but it's not the Kenpo that we know at all. It's not what I'm used to. It's not what I, you know, Kenpo has a sound. Kenpo is not a visual thing. And I think that unless we, what's happened now is all our seniors are dying and they're passing on. The great minds are leaving us. You know, Mr. White, you know, Mr. Canatra just passed away. You know, we had Trejo, Charlie, all these guys. I have a picture of me training and like seven of them are gone. And they were all my seniors. And they had a lot to offer and they had a lot of knowledge. But a lot of the people under them left so soon they never got that knowledge. There's a handful of us that make up the gap between the seniors and the generation of today, who we have that knowledge of what our seniors left us, but it's hard for us to get that knowledge to the next generation because they never got it. So a lot of the knowledge that we try to give them, they don't want to hear it. It's not what they do anymore. He goes, that's old stuff. That's old. That's old. That's old. But it isn't. It's the roots of the system. And I think unless some young people don't look up and start training and start talking to some of the older people that are left, we're going to lose a lot of the art. And that's what I'm afraid of. And so what I do when I teach is I teach the teachings that I was taught. And I teach, BTB is what I call it, back to basics. So when I do a seminar, I say, I'm going to teach you guys how to generate power. I'm going to teach you guys how to use your hips. I'm going to teach you guys how to hit. Then we'll go and we'll have a technique. We'll have fun. But now you'll know how to do it right. And so I'm trying to teach that. And I'm trying to teach the basics that I was taught by Trejo, by Faria, by Meadows, by Steve Herring, all these people that I trained with. And unless you get back to those basics, the art's going to change. And I think if you watch videos of people nowadays, it looks nice. It's very flashy. But then put your hand over their waist up and watch their legs and their feet and watch their belt. Their belt doesn't move, which means their hips aren't moving, which means their legs aren't moving, but their hands are extremely fast. So all the jokes about Kenpo are coming true. You know, you see the people slapping.
Oh, yeah.
They're
oh,
coming yeah. true because that's what's happening. People are so involved with speed and looking pretty that I think we're losing the base of the art. And, you know, every time a senior dies, there's another piece that just drops, you know, and you were hopefully fortunate enough to have studied with that senior and get what they used to teach you. Like Dennis Canatra passed away. And he was one of my nemesis is coming up, meaning that he was a judge all the time. And every time I would compete, he would say, Angelo, your forward bow sucks. You got to get this chin up. You got to do this. You need to fix this. You need to fix that. And he'd give me notes. I would win, but he'd give me notes. It's high. You know, and every time I do, he goes, come here. Let me tell you what you're doing wrong. And I would listen to him, you know, and I'd say, okay, Dennis, let Mr. Canaccio, let me hear what you got to say. And a lot of the stuff was right on, you know, it was right on. But I needed those eyes. And I needed that critique of someone who could see a form and tell you what it was about. One thing real quick about Trejo is that when Mr. Trejo is last year, he was in a wheelchair. He had no legs. He had half an arm and half a hand on the other side. And one of his students named Mark, he learned Form 4 from Frank. Frank Trejo taught him Form 4 from the wheelchair with one arm, no legs. And I watched Mark in his brown belt test, and he did a perfect Form 4. And that was based out of what Trejo taught from the wheelchair. That's a master. That's a teacher. That's somebody who had an eye that said, no, fix this, fix that. And so there's proof that it can be done. And that's one thing that I've never seen before, is to see such a perfect form come from somebody who couldn't even move themselves. And those are the things that need to be noticed in the Kempo of today. And I don't think anyone's paying attention to that. They just want to look pretty. And the younger generation is very eager to learn everything. And with the internet now, like I remember when I was coming up, I didn't get to see the guys from Europe until I went to Europe. I didn't know what they were looking like. I didn't know what they did. And now, I mean, you can spy on everybody and you can watch everybody. You can learn from everybody. But now you can't do that anymore. Everyone's so, they want everything at their fingertips and they think they know everything. And it's like, you guys got to slow down. You know, rank is going rampant. You know, you got 35-year-old seventh degrees. Hello. How's that possible? When I was coming up, the highest rank I ever saw was a sixth degree black belt. Until Parker died. And when Parker died, everything started happening. But to see a sixth degree, I was like mesmerized by that little stripe above that bar, you know. Now you got, and guys are, you know, 30 years old. I see them wearing sevenths and eight degrees. And it's like, how do you do this? You know, and how many tens do we got now? You know, it's just, the art's taken off into a place that I don't want to see it go. I like the old school, the old times. You know, that makes more sense. And I envy the Japanese arts because they've got it so together. You know, you go to their tournaments, you can go across the world, and if you do a form and your hand's wrong, everybody knows it. You do this wrong, everybody knows it. You know, you're not doing this right. And I love that. I love that about it, that everyone stays together and nobody is doing this, you know?
Yeah, the rank chasing and the flash. Yeah, the rank.
And all I can do is keep it to me. You know, my rank is legit. I'm spending at least as many years in rank as my rank is before I even think about even moving. I was 14 years as a fourth degree black belt because I didn't want to get bumped yet. And my son's another example. He started when he was 2 years old. He could have got his black belt when he was 16. He chose not to, and he trained until he was 22. When he was 22 years old, he tested for black belt, you know, after 22 years of or 21 years of training. And since then, he doesn't want to get promoted until he feels that he's ready to go. And that's the way the old school was. You know, it was traditionalized. It was your rank meant something. There's people that I sat on their board when I was a fourth degree black belt. I sat on their first degree black belt. And now they pass me up, you know, and you're like, oh, wow, must be smart. You know, but again, you watch them move and there's lacking so much of the basics. So that's kind of my spiel on where I think the art's going. I think you can still rectify it by just teaching your students the right way. And hopefully you plant some new seeds and get people moving. You know, that's what we did in Spain. We went back to the basics and we went to the old Friday night line and ran that in Spain. These guys didn't know what to do. Like, what is this? Well, this is the way we used to train. So we're going to start this seed over here now. And we're going to start training like we used to, different places. And hopefully we can get a whole new generation of people that are doing it the old, not the old non-functional way, the old traditional way of basics, you know?
Yeah, no, that's something that, you know, you have to have that good foundation. You have to We say this in the capoeira world a lot. You got to have your rice and beans. You can be fed on the rice and beans, but you can't be fed on the seasoning and the spices. It makes the dish great and all, but you can't survive off of that. So, yeah, we got to have that foundation, the rice and beans, the basics, make everything.
Now that you bring up capoeira, I have a friend who does capoeira. He's old school, and he's got massive power in those kicks, man. And then you see the new guys. They look pretty, but they can't kick nearly as hard as this guy. And you're going, what's the difference? It's like, this guy knows what he's doing. This guy looks like he knows what he's doing. And the capoeira kicks are especially impressive because of the body mechanics and the full body torque that you're supposed to put in them. And a lot of people just look like they do it. As you well know, you could vouch for watching that kind of thing happen all the time. Yeah,
for sure.
That's what I'm talking about. It's like, it's more visual than it is effective.
Gotcha. So we're going to move into our lightning round. There's a whole bunch of things that I'd love to get into, but we can't take a 24-hour podcast. Well, we could, but I'm sure you've got other things you want to do.
So.
But let's go move into our lightning round. Just a few little questions as we wrap up here. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
My favorite technique, I think, would be snapping twig. Hooking wings. I just like the movement of those two techniques. They encompass so many different variables. I just love them. And then I have a lot of my own favorite techniques that I've made up based on other techniques. But if I could pick, and thundering hammers, the basics. I just like the meat of the five swords, the meat and potatoes of the system. So mm-hmm. Those would be my favorite techniques.
Yeah, Kenpo All-Stars, as I like to call them, techniques that seem to exist in every version of
yes.
Kenpo. Thundering hammers, snapping twig, five swords. Yeah, those definitely are favorites among many a stylist. So, very nice. Next question: do you have a favorite form and or a set?
Form six. I have mastered the ability to perform form six, but I have not mastered the form yet. That makes sense?
Oh, yeah.
I learned the form six almost 25 years ago, and I still haven't gotten one that I really like yet. So, but yeah, that's definitely it's not the content of the form as much as the movement and the transitional phases and the movement of the form. The knife techniques and stuff are questionable, as we all know. But I love that form. So I would say form six, and form four is my second favorite.
Very nice. And
I do not like form three, long three. For me, I'll do it, and I practice it. It's just so repetitively dizziness and just kind of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's not my favorite to perform. That would be my least favorite of all the forms.
Gotcha. Yeah, I had remembered liking it more. It was never my favorite, but I thought that I remembered liking it a lot at my first school, and in my current school I recently kind of relearned it. I was like, while I still like it, I misremember how much I liked it.
It all has a reason. I just just don't have to like it.
exactly. All right. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Rambit.
I was kind of thinking you were going to go there.
I spent since 2000 training with that thing, 24 years with that blade. So yeah, Karambit 100%. And then if you're aware, I've got the Kenpo Karambit Association, the Kenpo Karambit mixture, in which I've incorporated the Karambit into a full Kenpo-esque format. So it's a lot of it is Indonesian, Malaysian, Kiri Tertia, and a lot of the arts mixed in with Kenpo base. So everything's Kenpo base. So I have a Kenpo engine with all the other structures on top of it. And that's what I call the Kenpo Karambit system that I teach all over the place. But yeah, it would have to be the Karambit for sure.
Very nice. We will definitely connect on that. I've been thinking about that a lot lately. So yeah, we're we're definitely going to have to talk about that offline. But I like it. All right. The next question: if there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, and because of your connection, I'm also going to take Frank Trejo off the table. Who would that be?
Somebody who I've never trained with.
It could be someone that you have trained with as well. Just as long as it's not Ed Parker or Frank Trejo, you can.
What's the question? Somebody who I would.
Anyone that you would, that you wish that you could train with, whether they're alive or not, or they're fictional, or real people, who would you like to be able to train with? If you've already trained with them, you can say them as well.
Yeah, I mean, everybody who I've already wanted to train with, who's alive, I have trained with. At some point, I would like to go back into the history and train with Yip Man.
Oh, nice, nice.
You know what I mean? As far as that goes, the legendary figure of somebody who really knew what was going on back in the day, even though it's not Kenpo. If there was a Kenpo person who I'd never got the opportunity to train firsthand with a lot, would be someone like Paul Mills.
Oh, nice.
You know, he passed away recently, and I never actually even met him, which is one of the few seniors that I never got an opportunity to even to meet with. And recently, I've started incorporating the Chuck Sullivan system with me. I just received my yellow belt. And I'm starting over in their system under David Gigliotti, who's one of the Brotherhood guys. And I've gone over to Mr. Sullivan's house and done stuff with him. And I've taught at his seminars on the East Coast and so forth. So I'm engaging myself in the Sullivan system now, just to learn that system, to continue having a teacher and to absorb the knowledge of this man who's 93 years old, who's still incredible.
Oh yeah, so, yeah. I'm working on getting him on the show. We just haven't got the schedule worked out, but he's gonna be on at some point. So
I would say alive would be Mr. Sullivan, which I am training with, and then in past would be Eatman. I would think that would be the two.
Very nice. I like it. I like it.
Interesting, huh?
All right. So now we're going to move to our shameless self-promotion. So now is your time to plug anything you want, or anything that maybe we hadn't talked about that you wanted to make sure we got out there. You have the floor, and now is your time to say whatever you'd like, and we'll close out from there.
Now, as far as plugging something, I'm always going to put a plug in for my Kenpo Karambit system. It's very good, especially if you're a Kenpoist, because in order to understand Kenpo, you have to do Kenpo for many, 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 many years. And once you understand that base and foundation, and you understand the logistics of how to move and what not to do and how to move, then we put the blade in your hand. And it's a combination that is different than any other combination. There's a lot of arts that are out there that have just the karambit. And it's just very, very hands only, very arms only. They don't have a lot of principles and concepts of the body in there. And when you mix them together, it just elevates that intensity and that functionality so much more. But you have to be a Kenpoist to understand that. A lot of people who aren't Kenpoists watch what I do and they go, no, that's just a karambit. I'm like, no, it's not. You don't understand until we train together. And once we train, they understand that I'm doing so much more with my body than I am with my hand, and they like it. I would just encourage those of you that are Kenpoists who would like to learn a blade, the way we've developed the Kenpo Karambit program, it's not going to change anything that you do, and it's not going to change anything at all. You're just going to have an extension of your body with a weapon, and you're going to learn a whole new world of applications with the Karambit. So I would love to get more people studying online with us, and just, you know, our school's open in San Dimas, California now, and we're starting to push our martial arts program intensely. Those of you that are in California, hello. Every Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, I have our blade time, in which we invite all practitioners. I don't care what you carry. Come on in and let's play, learn, and share ideas. That's how we grow. And pick up a karambit. I'll pick up your weapon, learn from you. You learn from us. But I'd like to get a new group going. So as far as plugging, I would plug the Kenpo Karambit and our new blade situation that's coming through. That's pretty much what I would definitely. And then also I encourage all of you people out there, as a challenge or a request, go out and train with some seniors and don't look at them like old men and old people. Look at them for what they do and for what they know. You're not going to learn anything from watching them because they're old and they don't move. What you're going to learn from them is asking them questions and talking to them about the art, okay? Speak to them. Get inside their head. You will learn things you've never seen. An example would be, I always learn from somebody, and I was just in Mexico when I was doing my form, and Mr. Gilbert Velez came up to me and he goes, do you know what you're doing in that move? I go, yeah, I'm doing a rear crossover. And he goes, no, you're not. And he showed me this whole move that I've never seen in my entire life. I've been doing this for how long? 50 years now. And I learned something that nobody ever taught me except for him. And it may have been his idea. It may have been his concept, but it works and it fits. So I learned something new. So I encourage everyone to train with somebody older and ask questions and develop your art that way. Don't just watch, because there's a bunch of older guys moving. They're not going to have that pop that they used to, but inside, they know what they're doing.
Very nice. Yeah, I agree with that 1,000,000%. So
yeah.
Boys and girls out there, yes, definitely. All of our seniors, they are not some untouchable, unapproachable people. I've definitely learned that from doing the show, that if you want to know something, go out there and get it.
The seniors that we have right now that are older, they put in their entire life of doing this, and they learn things from everybody, not like our people. So when generations below me are seniors, they're lacking a whole 20 or 30 years of information and training that they never got. So now's the time to get out there and talk to them before it's too late. You know, we will always have seniors, but the quality of the seniors is going to die out soon. It really is, you know, because there's so much that I didn't learn from Frank that he took with him that I wish I would have. So there's part that I missed out on too, and nobody will ever know it. So.
Yeah, for sure. No, get out there, folks. Get out there. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chit chat with me and tell me your story. And we will definitely have to do this again to get more of the great knowledge that is inside your brain and inside your body there. So we'll definitely have to do this again. But once again, I thank you for taking the time to chat with me, and look forward to getting this out for others to hear. And we'll keep fighting the good fight and spreading the good Kenpo message to all that's out there. So thank you.
All right, man. And thank you, Reggie. I mean, what this kind of stuff that you're doing also is really helping. It's keeping the ball rolling, keeping the flame going. And just these type of podcasts just kind of make the awareness there of what needs to be done. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.